This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is comedy writer Rob Long, who served as the producer of the great sitcom Cheers for years, writes the weekly Martini Shot commentary, and co-hosts the Glop Culture podcast with Jonah Goldberg and John Podhoretz. At a live event in New York City, I spoke with Rob about whether Hollywood is out of ideas, what it's like being a libertarian-leaning conservative in a very progressive industry, and the role that psychedelics have played in his creative process. Here is The Reason Interview with Rob Long. Earlier today, I talked to Rob and I had sent him a note saying, like, what are we going to talk about? And he said, to be honest, I'm sort of way more interested in issues of faith and the big questions, capital B, capital Q these days. The three things that I think a person is going to have to understand for the future are the blockchain, machine learning, and Jesus. So let's start with that. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with blockchain, machine learning, and Jesus?
Yeah. I guess what I meant by that was that the cliche is always that, you know, we know so many things now and all the mysteries are gone in life. And so really, where does faith belong, right? Because we're all very smart and we know that the dragon isn't chasing the sun across the sky every day. So what do you need to know? Like, if these things are all kind of fading away, what are the three things you need to know? And like, one is the blockchain, really, which I think is interesting technology, and it's going to be the universal ledger for payments and chain of title and copyrights and all sorts of things. And
the idea kind of like the Book of Names,
kind of like the Book of Names. Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah. Good for you. Wow. Mm. Oh. And then the second thing I think is machine learning. We all know the machine learning is big and it's going to be bigger and it's going to be a part of our lives no matter whether we like it or not. It's either going to be something we carry around in our pocket. Or it's going to be something that we have that's going to be our offsite brain. There's a very good app now called Mem, which is, I think it's still in beta, but you can join it and you create your own knowledge base. You can put everything you've ever written. You can put all of your journals in there. You can put anything you want in this, in Mem, and it creates a knowledge base based on what you've written and what you've said and what you've thought and what you put in. And you can say, hey, Mem, what do I think about daffodils? And it'll say, well, you know, as a matter of fact, you've been thinking a lot about daffodils. And then the third thing is Jesus, which is, I mean that in the capital J, but also in the idea that there's got to be something that we are doing here with ourselves and each other that is going to legitimize and detoxify the first two. And as I get older, I think that's what I think about more. What are we doing here?
And so, yeah, why Jesus though? In the sense of you're reaching for a religious figure,
yeah.
And you're not going for Buddha. You're not going for Abraham.
I'm an Episcopalian. I'm 58-year-old wasp. I'm going to go for what I know. Like, you can go for whatever you want to know. Like, God has a 99 faces or whatever they say. But, like, for me, that's who it is. And I also kind of like the fact that most people, especially in Hollywood, it is the most terrifying word that you can use. If you could bring I had a friend of mine who was pitching a great, really great series about the history of the development of the Glock. You know, the handgun, the Glock, which is this great lurid story. If you know the story, the development of the Glock handgun, it's fantastic. And it has everything in it. It has sex and violence and madness, and it's terrific. And he wanted to bring into the pitch, he wanted to bring a Glock and put it on the table and just have it there during the pitch. And half the people he was working with said, this is a great idea. And the other half said, this is a terrible idea. But had he done that, he never did it. Had he done that, he still would have gotten a better response than I would do if I walked into any pitch meeting and said, I got it. Okay. It's about Jesus. No, wait, stop. Yeah. Let me finish before they send me out. Because it's terrifying. People are
terrifying. You're putting the crucifix on the table.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's scarier than a clock.
I want to bring you the good news. Like, I know, I'm not that guy.
So, I mean, you talk about, you know, partly what you're dealing with is a world of abundance as opposed to scarcity, right? So, like, and this is part of things like machine learning and AI and, blockchain. You know, most of us, and increasingly across the globe, the Brookings Institution a few years ago tabulated that most people around the planet are now living at a middle-class level or above for the first time in history. I mean, it's makes like sense. Amazing. Like, in not in a perfect way, but in a profound way, we've beaten scarcity. And that leaves more time for symbolic work.
Yeah. Also, I feel like we, I mean, you and I talked about this, like, there's nothing more irritating to me than people who begin their political philosophy or their social philosophy or whatever their position is based on scarcity, that there's not enough and that we need to conserve the good stuff that we have. And I just think that's completely wrong. And it's kind of a pose rich people usually use, so they don't have to give anything away. And it's just, it's belied by all the facts. And when you tell people that, like, today was the best day to be alive on the planet in the history of the planet today. And tomorrow will be a little bit better than today. You stub your toe tonight and you're not going to die of sepsis. You're just not. And that's just not the case not that long ago. So, and not, you know, not to like lay a lot of Christian stuff on you, because we all, you know, we're all just as God made us or whoever made us. And I'm not, it's a whole bunch of stuff I don't believe, by the way. So I'm not, I'm the worst person to be having this conversation. But the message is, okay, what are you worried about? You're worried that you're going to be lonely. You're worried that's not going to be enough love for you. You're going to worry that you're not going to have any of the things that you want. You're going to worry that when you die, you're just going to disappear. Big, deep fears. And then along came a guy 2,000 years ago, and he said, okay, don't worry about that. You're fine. Everything's fine. You're going to be fine. Now what? So now what do you do in a world of abundance? Which is something that we don't want to think about. So we prefer to go back to our scarcity, right? Because it's much easier to think about what I don't have than like, oh, everything's fine. Because in my faith tradition, which is not probably, I know it's not yours, but it's like, you know, it's not probably even capital C Christian. Whatever, what has been, what we say was, what has been given was given to be given again. And in a world of abundance, what we're called to do is to, we're called to give. And that is like not easy and actually not that pleasant.
So I like what do you give? Like how, I mean, make this concrete. What does it mean?
Well, I'm terrible. No, I consider this, you know, like I'm bad at it. I'm really bad at it. Like you walk by the guy and like you walk by the homeless guy. And I've been on the board of a homeless youth agency in LA for 30 something years. And mostly what we're told.
And you're happy to report you have more homeless there now than ever.
Yeah, we've been doing a great job. I don't know if you noticed. Yeah. Yeah, you get what you, all systems work. That's what you learn. Right. You get what you, the system. Anyway, what I said was like, partly you say to yourself, well, the goal here is to drive them to services. So you don't give them money because you give them money, you're just going to encourage them. You want to drive them to services, which is probably true. But, I don't know, what the hell, just, I got a few bucks. I'm not going to solve the big problem. I'm just not. So I'm just going to do one little nice thing, and it may be detrimental in the large scheme of things, but I don't care anymore. So that's, I don't know, that's probably an unsatisfying answer to most people, but that's mine.
Was there a moment when, did you have a Damascus Road experience where you're like, okay, rather than talking about scarcity and rather than living my life as if things are being taken away from me, I'm in a different space. Like where did that transformation come from?
Well, I mean, a lot of things, like when you get to be a certain age and you work in show business, you know, it's a problem. It's like, you know, you open the Variety and it says, you know, show running veteran. I'm like, I mean, I'm veteran. I feel like I'm a very vibrant young man, right? I mean, I started when I was 24. So I was like a kid. That's my only job I've ever really had has been walking into a room, sitting on a sofa and trying to make jokes for people. That's really literally it. I mean, that's it. And you get to be a certain age and like, you know, like, well, this, you're not working quite, nobody's calling you the way they used to. And then the money gets smaller because the money in show business has gotten smaller for everybody. And then you start to think, okay, well, what does this mean? Like, Do I still exist? What am I going to do? And that's sort of a little mini crisis you have. And you think, well, what if I just didn't have any of the things that I have? How bad would that be? And it, you know, really bad. I mean, that's the first thing you think is really bad. And then you think, okay, well, what else do I got? What am I here for? And so it wasn't really a road to Damascus so much. It was a road to my, you know, my accountants who said, when I moved to New York, he said, this is like, are you, what are you thinking about? Are you not working? Is there another accountant somewhere who has access to other money that I don't know about? And I said, no, I'm just going to just see what happens. And I mean, what's happened, of course, is that you got to work, it turns out. But I don't have to do this. I can do whatever I want. And I think that's part of the road was like, okay, well, if I'm okay, then why am I okay?
Could you put this in a larger context, as we're in, you know, we're in a society right now, we're in a political moment. I wouldn't necessarily say this is true of society, but when it comes to politics, things are extremely polarized. The major parties have smaller market share than they had 50 years ago or even 20 years ago, but the dead enders in them are more vociferous and more committed than ever. Are they responding to the same thing you are, but they're saying, I need to hang on to this because this is all I have? Or, you know, and then if that's true, how do you connect with people like that so that we become less polarized and more, centered around something like the common good?
It was much easier when we didn't know how dumb all of our neighbors were and all the stupid things that they believed. And now we do.
And that's because of social media.
Yeah, everybody's telling you. Well, everybody's got an opinion. I can tell you their opinion. Like, everybody in this room is going to tell you their opinion if they want. So that was sort of better then, when you didn't really have to know these things. Like, you could kind of live your life. I don't know whether I have often thought about things happening in culture as things that are happening to me and not things that I am doing. We're all very polarized, we say. I think we're polarizing ourselves. And you can feel it. You could sometimes tell, like, really smart people will suddenly get really angry when they discover that you're not voting for the candidate they want you to vote for, or that you have some weird, slightly divergent attitude about some world event that isn't, you're not wearing the jersey, like, put the jersey on. I used to joke that when I in 2020 that I'd read the paper, the New York Times or something, and some what I would consider to be crackpot liberal progressive politics, and I'd say, these people will not rest until I am wearing the MAGA hat. They want me to wear the MAGA hat, and I don't want to wear the MAGA hat. I don't believe in the MAGA hat. I don't support the MAGA hat. But for some reason, the editorial board of the New York Times, they wake up every morning, they think, how can we piss him off so much? How can we be so weird that he's just going to wear the MAGA hat? And so partly it's my fault, which is to not thread the needle my own way. Is that an answer? I don't know if it is.
I think it might be. Talk about, you know, what is the image of Jesus then? Because you talk about Jesus, right? You mentioned him in your opening comments. What do you kind of refract through him? Or, you know, what does he symbolize in this?
Well, you know, he's a genuinely weird dude. And I'm not sure I believe all the stuff you're supposed to. No, I mean, you're a good Catholic. You probably went and...
I'm a very bad Catholic, which is say the best
Catholic
kind.
Boy, yeah,
the best
kind. The Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, all that stuff. Like, I don't know if I believe in that. I don't know if I'm supposed to. I don't really think that he wants me to. So I think the part... It's easy and hard, right? He said... you only have two commandments, love God and then love each other as God loves you, right? So you take the gift and then you give it away. I don't like that. That's hard, right? I'd much rather, be a consultant in Christianity for other people, rather preach than live, right? And then the second thing he says is if you have two, it's very simple. You have two coats, give one away. And so for 2,024 years, there's been an endless amount of writing and thinking and philosophy and and exegesis of that, because he can't possibly mean that he just thinks you should give one of your coats away. Because that's just, like, first of all, I like my coats. I have really nice coats. Some are cashmere. Some are, like, Laura Piana. Like, he can't mean, instead of giving that away, I think what I'd rather do is, depending on the year, I'd rather, like, make difficult for some Jews or some gay people, or, like, you know, find some more doctrinaire way to, like, exhibit my faith rather than the way that he's asked you to, which is to just give one of your coats away or see his face in the Jungian thing, the last person on earth you'd imagine or want to see his face in. That's the person whose face, that's the call.
Right? How many coats do you, if I go to Rob Long's apartment, how many coats do you have hanging there? Can you even count them?
I only have one. Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I am so shitty at being a Christian that I should be something else. But that doesn't make it wrong. It actually kind of, like, it's one of the ways you know it's right is that I can't bring myself to do it.
Is there a different, you know, so Christianity, Judaism, Islam are all Abrahamic religions, right? They seem to have, you know, they all worship kind of the same God or concept, but they seem to be very different. You know, why is your guy Jesus as opposed to Moses?
Because he's like he's groovy. Like, he's the groovy one. He's the one who's like a very short book. And a lot of it's the same story, just told in a different way. So really short, cryptic. And then slippery, a lot of stories. Like, that's kind of what I like. I like stories. And not as interested in your social status or how much money you have or whether you even go to church. Not that interested in it. And that kind of speaks to me.
What do you do with the amount of hell talk that Jesus brings? You know, because the Old Testament has some visions of hell, but it's really like eternal damnation is a Christian thing and it's a New Testament thing. You know, God is love, but God is also the one who's talking about Jesus throwing people into a lake of fire that they'll never get out of. How does that fit into this?
I ignore that part. I just do. It was written by dudes. There's a lot of stuff in it that doesn't go together.
Is the showrunner in you. You're like, stuff that's
years
played.
And years ago, a friend of mine was working with Stephen J. Cannell. I know somebody, sure. The great producer, produced
Magnum PI
and a million other Rockford File. And they wanted to do a Baywatch. But instead of on the bay, it was going to be set on the border. Baywatch on the border.
It's so sexy.
Yeah. And it was kind of funny, you know, people border patrol. You know, Baywatch. And so when they pitched it, and someone said, well, what are you going to do about, like, the miserable stuff happening on the border? Like, the mountain of skulls in Ciudad Juarez and the cartels and the people coming over and getting eaten by wolves. And what are you going to do about that? And Cannell said, we're not going to write that part. Which is a great answer, actually. Because, you just don't write it. And no one says, I would enjoy this show more if it was more depressing. I would enjoy the show more if there was more, human misery on screen. No one ever says that. So so the Lake of Fire stuff, like, I'm not qualified to analyze it, but the people that I know who, like, speak the thing, the languagey stuff, that's the technical term, and dig up the things from the jars. It's not quite the Lake of Fire. It's something else. So I sort of believe that it's hell is what we put ourselves through on Earth.
What, are people then, I mean, they're suffering, would you agree they're suffering from too much freedom in the sense of that? They have more options in lives. They have more ability to create the world and the meaning that they want. And on some profound level, let's say in the United States at least, doing, I think it was Eric Fromm who talked about the escape from freedom. Is that what's going on, that our material needs are basically met?
Yeah.
We're way up on Maslow's hierarchy, and like we're like, forget it. I don't want to deal.
Oh, the anxiety of choice is really there. I mean, anyone who's ever tried to watch TV in, you know, yesterday, it's like, what? I mean, I used to come home from work and, you know, flop on the sofa and turn on the TV and flip through stuff. And I could flip through. Flipping through, by the way, was a show. I enjoyed that on my DirecTV. I just flipped through everything. If it's a movie, oh, My Cousin Vinny, I'm going to watch that. And then something else, oh, it's going to be the guy. Whatever, you'd stop. And that would be watching TV. And you didn't have to make a choice. Now, of course, you have to make a choice about everything, right? What your destination is, you have to know. So that, I think that's anxiety of that. But it seems to me we're more interested and more obsessed and more like exercised by the choices other people are making. It's like we can hear their voices now. And so like, I don't know what that guy is doing. Like I think it's dumb to walk around wearing a mask. I think it's dumb. You want to wear a mask? I don't care. Go ahead, wear a mask. If that's your thing. I saw a woman in San Francisco last autumn in one of those Waymo, you know, Google taxis, alone, wearing a mask in the robot car, wearing a mask, which I thought was perfect. That's exactly, she's at the pinnacle of technology. This is something that people are dreaming about for 1,000 years. This thing that takes, I'm just going to kill a bunch of people. These things don't work, but you're just going to like, and she's still, I got to wear. And that's, I think, the fear of choice, right? The, what if I don't have to worry about that stuff? And I prefer it. You know, here's a horrible image. But it's true. They used to do these diving things with kids. Have you ever taught kids swimming in the old days? And they would, you know, to get them used to the pool, you throw in something heavy and they would dive in and they would grab it and they would come back up and they bring the heavy thing up to, and it was the one way to get them. And some kids drowned because they held on to this thing that was heavy and took them to the bottom of the pool and they just forgot to let go. And it sounds horrible and completely like bananas, but it also sounds really human. And that's the thing you want to think about. It's like, what am I holding on to that I could just let go of? And then I could rise to the top. Maybe.
This seems like a good moment to introduce psychedelics into the conversation.
And it's something positive. I'm very sorry.
And by the way, I could have
ruining
said
your Thursday.
I could have said that at any moment in this conversation.
Yeah, right.
No, but you've talked about your experiences with psychedelics and how that has helped you kind of move through difficult periods in life or clarify your thinking. How does that fit into, you know, this larger kind of topic that you're discussing?
Well, everybody's different. Everybody's brain is different, kind of, actually, but also like not that different. You know, we're not really that different. For me, it was more like, I went to Costa Rica and I did ayahuasca for 5 days straight, which is exhausting.
How did you come to that? Like how you were like?
Oh, because I was doing these weird, I was doing a bunch of psychedelics kind of like on my own. And I suddenly thought, I don't know anything about this. I never took drugs. I mean, in college, I think it was like, we did cocaine. God, I hope my mother doesn't hear this, but we did. And I was like, you know, I don't know. I don't need anything to help me stay awake or be, I need something to stay awake, but I mean, to be more, have more fun at a party. I don't need that. Although this is, it's all I need. So I was doing all that stuff and I thought I'm a gentleman of a certain age. I should make sure this is okay. Like, I don't want to have some embarrassing medical event. So I I was living in New York and I went and I Googled. This is the house of my thinking. I thought psychiatrists, because they're an MD, who do ketamine therapy. Because my theory was, if you're a shrink who does ketamine therapy, you're going to be cool with all this other stuff that I'm doing. You can't, you know, you're not going to be able to draw the line. And I found one who was great. And he ended up being, he's kind of an influential guy in the world and was very helpful for me. And so I started going to him just because I want to know, I'm not going to get a heart attack and die. How do I do this? And he was very helpful. And then I saw him for like a 2 months, 3 months. And then my dad died. And And then I started seeing him just because of that, because that was very, you know, very painful. And then I ended up saying, I just want to do this ayahuasca stuff. And he says, well, I know a place. I help set it up. And so I went down to this place. And it's exhausting. And the message there was that I got, right? A lot of messages in ayahuasca, which is like some people I was there with would say like that night or the next morning or something, you know, I went to the undersea kingdom and Mother Ayahuasca showed me the daffodil people or whatever. And I'm like, I walked in my grandparents' house and then suddenly I was in middle school. I didn't see any undersea kingdom. I didn't have any of that. I don't have that part of my brain works. I don't like The Lord of the Rings. I hated that movie so much. I don't do the Hobbit stuff. The three body problem everybody loves is so dumb. I hate it. I do not have an imagination. I like me. I want to think about me and my life. And so that helped. Because I discovered so when I came back, I was having dinner with some friends of mine, and one guy who was not really my friend, but he's kind of a, you know, we all have these jerky friends. And so I just got back from Costa Rica. I did ayahuasca for a week. I just, I'm just going to have water. And he goes, oh, really? How was that? Did you have any revelations? He's one of those guys, right? Did you see God? Did God show up? Like, do you have any revelations? And I'm like, well, I did. Last night I did. And he's like, oh, everybody quiet. I'm going to hear the revelation. What was the big revelation? And I said, well, last night, after like a lot of stuff, but last night I just was like, sitting there in this hut in Costa Rica, and like it was raining outside. It was really pretty. And I heard this voice, which was either my voice or somebody's voice, or just maybe it was the wind, who knows, saying over and over again for hours, it felt like, these 5-6 words. There is so much time left. And his response was, will you send me the link to that place? And I said this when I did my radio commentary. I said it on KCRW, so it was on public radio. And I would talk about show business I did this for 16 years. And every now and then somebody would like write me an email or something, or I'd go to a meeting and people say, oh, I liked the thing you did last week. I got so many responses from that one, from people sending me emails with domains like jpmorganchase.com and, you know, privatswain.com, like places where people clearly are looking for something.
What do you think that speaks to? Is it, the idea that we're stuck in a kind of rat race or a status trap? You mentioned being a WASP, so... You know, as somebody who is raised Irish and Italian Catholic, I had a very, I don't think I ever met a WASP until I went to college.
And, yeah. That's how we arranged it.
Yeah. And you have like a vision of them as particularly emotionally stunted. If white ethnics are too emotional, WASPs like have no emotion. Is that what was being unleashed in you
I still think of myself as having no emotion. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think that's probably true. It goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning, which was like, and that's something I really believe, which is that there is so much time left. Everything you need to do to make your life full, to forgive people, to forgive yourself, to love people, love yourself, you can do it in an instant. You can do it right now. You do not need... Psychedelics are neither necessary nor sufficient, said my old shrink, by the way, who was kind of a really good way to put it. Psychedelics are neither necessary nor sufficient for healing, right? But everything you need to do, you can do right now. There is plenty of time left. And that tends to be, at least for me, what I had the hardest time accepting. Because I always felt like, oh, I'm late. I miss that. There's so much time left.
Talk about that a little bit more. So you're not late for your life. Your life is unfolding as you're living it. But how is it just something you toss off? Like, I no longer feel that I wasted my life, or that my life is over, or that the party is over before I show up?
Yeah, I think it's more like, I mean, I'm a writer, so, and I'm for 30 years, I wrote very practical. My output was very practical. It's either about my life specifically, about my business specifically, and about the people in my life specifically. So I did that on the radio, and I did that. I wrote two books about it. Like, that's like, you know, very specific. Or it was four characters that I had created or had been created, and I was trying to like pitch to that guy, that whoever that guy is. I wanted to like get his voice. And which is great, by the way. I loved it. I still love it. It's great. It's lots of fun. But it's not the same thing as writing what you feel or who you are. And at a certain point, if you're that kind of writer, you think, well, I can't really tell you who I really am, because that's not the job. It's not the gig. And if you write humor, especially, which is this weird combination of incredibly aggressive behavior, right? I mean, if you want to make people laugh, that's an aggressive act, right? It's not, you're changing the way they breathe. You're choking people. Like, it's like when you laugh, you're like, oh my God, I'm like, and like, that's the kind of, it's kind of a weird aggressive thing that you do to people. And then on the other, so the one hand is very aggressive. On the other hand, it's desperately, desperately needing approval. So it's like this weird, crazy dichotomy that can get in the way. Or it can also, like, you know, I don't know, like, you can make a nice living at it. I mean, you can really make a really nice living in, especially in show business, not being yourself. But eventually you run out of string and you gotta, like, I don't know, what am I gonna, like, I'm a show running veteran. Yeah, and not a writer.
Yeah. Do you, some people talk about psychedelics as non-specific amplifiers or drugs where, you know, rather than giving a particular insight across time and across individuals or circumstance, that they basically make people into a bigger version of themselves. Do you think that's true, or do you feel like your experience cuts across that?
It can't be true. I think it can be true. It depends on how you approach it. I mean, all the MDMA trials, not all of them, but the ones I've read about, certainly the ones that the MAPS has just finished that are pretty amazing, those are people who've been, the people going have severe trauma of some kind. You know, what we all recognize as like, oh, that was serious. Not somebody saying, I'm really traumatized by my, you know, parents being, you know, mean to me about my grades. That's not that. And so I think that MDMA does not amplify the feelings of trauma, of being traumatized. It amplifies the feelings of being okay. So, but for me, I feel like maybe I just haven't done enough, which is hard to believe, but.
There is so much time left.
There is so much time left. I don't think I've ever had a psychedelic experience that I didn't want to end so I could go back and be in the world. Like I every time I've done it, I've thought, oh, I can't wait to not be in this room with this person and I'd be out. So if anything, it amplified my desire to sort of be with people. Have you felt that?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure. I need to think about that.
Yeah. I think we should do a Little Singer series with you.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. You know.
I'm gonna open that hood.
Yeah. All right. That's that's a big.
See what's in there.
That's a big pit.
I didn't say it was gonna be pretty.
Yeah. Let's before we go to questions, let's talk a little bit about Hollywood. And one of the things that you've come back to over the years is the seeming unwillingness of Hollywood, if some, you know, kind of reified industry still exists that can be called Hollywood. Is there unwillingness to really try to have big hits that they seem to, you know, Cheers is a good example, and Cheers, maybe one of the last shows, even more than Seinfeld, which kind of moved into its slot. But Cheers was the number one show, and it had a massive audience for its time that you just don't see anymore. What is driving, you know, what is driving Hollywood not to try and do these kinds of massively popular shows or movies or books?
Yeah, I mean, there's three things, right? One is just the realities that the audience is atomized and that we're all watching something different, and there's a giant streaming service, then, you know, there's unlimited store width, unlimited bandwidth, leads to this kind of like separation. That is true. And so if you ask anybody who runs one of these companies or is strategizing here, they will say that is the reason. And maybe partly, I'm not going to say it isn't, but the other part is just this fear. Or I shouldn't say fear, it's this unwillingness to accept that show business, the entertainment business, is utterly impossible to plan or organize or predict. You cannot reverse engineer a hit. You cannot do it. And there are a lot of people in entertainment business now who are like, well, that can't be true because I got a Harvard MBA and we learned how to build a system. And if I could just build a system right, then we wouldn't have to, I wouldn't need to like take pictures and like take flyers. And I wouldn't need to treat this as a venture business that basically fails a lot. And when it succeeds, it's like succeeds in a way that I couldn't predict. The problem with show business now is that so many very, very smart people are in it. It was much better when it was just dumbasses, just, you know, making decisions on the seat of their pants and saying, that sounds interesting, let's do that. It was much better. The hit ratio was much higher. It's arrogance and fear. And then it's this third thing, which is the idea that like, we all got very smart about business, right, in the 80s and 90s. And so these are people who think like, okay, well, how different could it be from making Oreos? It can't be different. And of course it's totally different. And nobody wants to believe that. I remember Brandon Tartikoff, who ran NBC for a long time, left NBC, then was chairman of Paramount Studios. And he was kind of an interesting character, and this is a million years ago. And this is before Paramount was then owned by, it was a Gulf of Western company, then changed to Paramount Communications. So the owners, the CEO of Paramount was in New York.
The Gulf Western building was where Trump has a building in Columbus Circle now.
Yeah, I think so, maybe, yeah. And one Sunday he wakes up Monday morning, and he reads the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and they did a magazine piece on Brandon Tartikoff. And Tartikoff says, and the pull quote is, basically what I do is a crapshoot. And he was fired, basically. He was fired within 6 months from saying that. Because Martin Davis, who ran Paramount, was like, you can't say that. It isn't. First of all, it isn't. It's a lie. And second of all, you can't say it because I have shareholders who expect that this is not a crapshoot. The thing is that it's a crapshoot. Actually, it's not a crapshoot because a crapshoot, like, those are pretty good odds, actually. The best odds in the casino are craps, right? It's a slot machine. It's rigged against you. The movie you think is going to be great is going to die. The TV show that you've put all this effort and money into is going to die. If you're Amazon Studios today, you spent $1 billion in The Lord of the Rings, which seemed like a no-brainer, and it's a disaster. It cost them $1 million, $1 billion, and another $500 million to sell. Nobody's buying it. And the show that's keeping the lights on, if it wasn't already on, is a show called Reacher, which is about a giant man mountain of a guy who just moves to a town and kills all the bad guys in the most elaborate ways you can imagine, and then goes to another town. And it's stupid and great. And I guarantee you nobody at Amazon said, you know, Reacher. They didn't say that. You don't know. And that's the bad, that's it, it, you should come into the office every day saying, I don't know shit about shit. I'm just going to say yes to stuff that seems interesting. And when they don't do that, it's when they get in trouble. But there's no fix for it. And if you don't like that, don't be in show business. It's like, these are terrible businesses to invest your money in. They are terrible. The ROI on a show business, share of a show business company is just ridiculous. And that's fine. There's no law that says that everything's got to be a big you know, shareholder bonanza. This is not. This is crapshoot. Not even that. And the ones who succeed, succeed for a few years, and then they get unlucky. That's, people got fired in show business for years for being unlucky. And that is the way it's supposed to be. And instead, now they're fired because they've missed their quarterly, you know, whatever. Yeah. Well, they actually don't get fired. Nobody gets fired.
Do you think, given the vast amount of stuff that gets produced every year, plus everything that was ever produced is available somewhere,
yeah,
are we in a golden age of content production? Or does that become a problem where there's just too much stuff and we can't really focus? And, you know, a great show can be kind of aesthetically perfect and wonderful, but it doesn't matter if it doesn't have a certain size audience. That's part of the thing that makes it great.
Well, in olden times, meaning 10 years ago, you could only really make money if you had more than one revenue stream. So if you were making TV shows and you were a studio, you were deficit financing every episode, every series. So the network that would basically rent the show. I mean, NBC rented Cheers from Paramount. And then they, you know, they got to show it three times in a year for free. And then the rights reverted back to Paramount, and Paramount collected them in stacks and then sold the stacks to 200 TV markets around the country. So just imagine that. That was great money, right? One episode, you get paid by the network to make it. Usually it was less that you, over time was it got, but you started, it was a deficit. And then you get the reruns, you sell the reruns 200 times, you know, so you have 200 episodes, 200 times 200 times a million, and it starts to get really interesting. The money's pretty good, right? Now you don't have that. You have unlimited store width, unlimited bandwidth. So the comparison I would use is the music business, right? In the old days, music competed with other new music because, you know, like you're going to get up and you're going to go over there where the records are, or the CD rack is that you got it from Crate and Barrel, and you're going to get new, the old CD, and you're going to put it in the CD changer. It's like, no, that's too hard. People don't, that's the other thing, people don't like to change. You competed with new music. Because your old music was in the thing, and it was like the, by the time that even the CD thing, it was like fuzzy, it's hard to see the spine, and you didn't put it back in alphabetical order like you said you were going to. So you could never find what you wanted. So you just put new music, competed with new music, and that was that. But when it's unlimited store width, so everything is the same choice. Now it's music, new music competes with all the music that has ever been recorded in the history of recorded music. And it drives a giant hole through the business, which is what happened in the music business. It wasn't that so much that people weren't buying it or whatever. It was more just that, like, I can listen to anything I want. And maybe today, right now, I want to listen to that, you know, I want to listen to Rubber Soul, which I can't remember where it was on my CD rack that I got at Crate and Barrel in 1991.
We're going to go to the audience, and as we're setting up that, and Jackie, can you have the first questioner stand up? But as we're setting up the camera for that, Rob, was there a TV show that made you say, I want to work in TV?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it was some combination of those great comedies in the 70s, like Taxi or Fawlty Towers. The idea that you could come up with characters and they'd be funny over time and funny 26 or sometimes 28 times a year. But I think for, in terms of comedy, the thing I remember the most was one night in the summer. And I must have been 10, maybe 11. And I was swimming in the swimming pool. We lived in Northern California, had a pool, and I was swimming with the pool. And my brother came home from seeing a movie called Airplane. And he said, this is the funniest movie I've ever seen in my entire life. And he goes and he tells me all of the jokes from the movie Airplane. And if you're like 11, like I was on the floor. Like, my brother cannot tell a joke, right? He's not a funny person, but this was funny. And I said, I got to go see this movie. Went to see it the second time the next day. I already knew all the jokes. And I was on the floor laughing at the movie Airplane, not because it was revolutionary, but because it was giving me permission to laugh at something that I didn't know that I thought was funny. Like, I didn't know that these disaster movies that I had been watching were stupid and funny, but I knew there's something weird about them, but I didn't know what it was. And then these guys came along and gave us permission to laugh at them. And I'm thinking that's a really good gig.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to the first question.
Rob, you mentioned the genre of comedy. It's been a while since there's been a really good comedy that's come out, I think. And I mean, I guess the sensibilities of screenwriting tend to lag kind of popular culture by a few years, given the production cycle of Hollywood films. And, you know, I think it's pretty well acknowledged that, you know, 3 or 4 years ago is kind of when maybe we reached this, you know, it's debatable, but people call it peak wokeism, if you will, or peak woke, right? The time when sensibilities became so finely attuned that there was nothing permissible that was funny. So when is that going to end?
Well, I will be an ordained Episcopal priest by the time that happens. I don't know, but like everybody in this room has said this, thought this, had this said to them, had a conversation like where the phrase begins, well, they couldn't do that now. And sometimes it was they couldn't do that now, and it's like some like horribly racist thing from a 1937 movie. You're like, oh, they couldn't do that now. But sometimes it's something that happened 18 months ago that you couldn't do that now. So I'm not really sure. I don't know. I think it's two things, right? There's fear, and then there's kind of the woke sensibility which creates fear, right? Which is like everyone agrees it's gone too far in show business. There's nobody saying, oh, it's great. It's gone too far, but I don't want to be the first guy. I'm not the first. And then the third thing is just you comedies you can't plan, right? I mean, it's hard now to remember because you've seen the movies. But if you hadn't seen the movie Anchorman and you read the script for Anchorman, you'd say, the fuck is this? Right? Like what is this shit? I don't know. He's like, what? Is this even real? What is this? Is it funny? But if it's like, if I say, okay, it's a script, read it, whatever. It's Will Ferrell and he's got all his friends in it and it's going to be really funny and just do it. Just make it. Then you think, okay, well, Will Ferrell's kind of funny. Like, I mean, Zoolander. You read the script of Zoolander. It's hard now because you know the movie. You read the script and you're like, I know everything that happened in the movie. You read the movie and you're like, read the script, like, what the hell is this? Is this funny? It doesn't seem funny. But it's like Ben Stiller, it's got an eye, you know, these are funny people. So you take a flyer on the talent and you trust that it's going to probably be great. It might not be. It may be a giant disaster, but okay. Then you swing again. But there was a time, not that long ago, where every single summer had two or three big feature comedies that people went to see and they talked about them. And then they like, you know, they, the catchphrases were everywhere and they were in production for the sequel by Labor Day. And it's hard to believe that took guts, but it took guts, I guess, because they don't do it now. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, it's a no-brainer. A big, loud, noisy summer comedy where like, Will Ferrell's screaming at somebody and John C. Reilly's in it and it's Talladega Nights, which is still a really funny movie. Like, why aren't we doing that? Like, it's like a self-owned. It's like a economic suicide. It's like, this is what we do in show business. And we don't do that. And the answer to your question is, I have no idea. But it's going to take someone, I mean, I think there's money out there, someone just taking a risk and saying, what if we just made a funny comedy? Just that. It's not going to make you a better person. It's not going to make you rethink something. It's going to be funny. What about that? And I bet you that person's going to make $1 billion.
Next question.
Hi. Is Jesus a Republican?
No.
A libertarian?
Nope. Unfortunately.
No labels.
Yeah, no labels. Yeah. He's probably a really, 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 really bleeding heart liberal. And it drives people crazy, but it's kind of what he is, I think. And the good news is built into the Christianity is the idea that I'm going to fail at it anyway. So I can say, he's a big bleeding heart liberal. I'm not, no way.
He did have that bit about rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's, right?
And yeah, that was the no labels part. That was the more of the, I'm not part of this charade you guys are playing. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately, for conservatives.
Okay. Next question.
See, Jesus ends every conversation. Yeah. See, like this.
I guess the next question is, was the Glock movie a comedy?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, it was awful. It was a tragedy and terrible, and we have to, whatever, we have more regulation and all that stuff, whatever. But yeah, it was great. It was great.
Yeah, you were talking about how in the olden days, they were going. Producer was going to do a version of Baywatch on the Border with only the happy stuff, and that was how things were done. So what does it mean that we now have all of these dystopian films and all of these anti-heroes and all that? So what changed, and how does that affect what it's made? What does that say about the culture?
I don't know about the dystopian stuff. I think it's we're just happier being unhappy. But you notice the dystopian, like when New York City was this shitty cesspool for real. The movies about it were sort of matter of fact in a way, right? It was like, well, you know, things aren't going to get any better. This is the way it is. Taxi Driver makes total sense. It's not dystopian. It's like, oh, this is the way it is.
It's documentary realism.
Yeah, right. I mean, taking a Pelham 123, it's a crazy moment where like the guy is holding a giant subway car hostage. He's going to kill everybody. And then the guy who is the cop in charge, when someone says, oh my God, we have to give him the money, otherwise he's going to kill everybody. And he goes, what do they want for the lousy 20 cents to live forever? Or whatever it was, right? Super dark, right? But nobody said, oh, that's a very dystopian view. They said, no, it's New York City in 1974. And then New York City got really nice. And they cleaned up Times Square, and you can sit outside, and there's a little panini place. And that's when all the dystopian movies started. Like if you watch these Batman movies, which I hate because I have no imagination, so don't come at me. They're always like, the dystopian New York City. Like, are you kidding me? It's the nicest place in the world. It hasn't been dystopian since 1991. It's like there's a Chipotle and the Kooples and a thing. And it's like, what are you worried about? Like, it's nice. Like, there's an M&M store. And why are we, that may be the dystopia. You may not like that, but it's not like, oh my God, it's so dark. And like, there's the soulless city that hasn't been around for, you know, years. People now, like young people, because I can say this now, because I'm not one.
You're a show running.
Yeah,
veteran.
I'm show veteran. Yeah. They complain about shit in New York City. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Yeah, I get it. That's a crazy bird. I get it. That's bad. But like 1990, there were people getting shot. And you're getting mugged and no radio in car signs. Like, that was dystopian. You could walk across Tompkins Square Park and like you crush vials under your shoes. Like, it was like you're walking on snow. And now Tompkins Square Park, it's like, you get a $6 bottle of a cup of coffee and a vegan everything burger. Like, come on. So I don't know. I just think if the world is shitty and dystopian and we live in a world of scarcity and things are going downhill, then I am not called to love my neighbor because, like, I don't have time for that. So I kind of prefer that world in a weird, perverse way.
Let's do two more up front. Oh, I'm sorry. We've got one in the back. No. We have a system.
Oh, no. So sorry.
We have a system. Now they're going to accuse me of nepotism. Yeah. Okay, I have a question for Rob. In the days of Cheers, it seems like even though there was a lot of political divide, we were much less polarized. I was wondering if you could speak to polarization and why we're so polarized now and what the role of entertainment could be in perhaps uniting us and creating more unity in the world.
Anybody else want to? First of all, okay, full disclosure, I think we've never been more polarized than we are now, but we're not as polarized as people think. And I think once you atomize entertainment, and so you get your own entertainment the way you get your own news, that's the world of the two share, the one share, the million viewers. It's a hard way to make a living. Like that's a tough business to be in, as the shareholders of Warner Brothers Discovery and all these other places are discovering. Like you start going for a million people, and you're trying to make them squeeze some kind of money out of like these tiny audiences. It's tough. But you don't have to actually, entertainment doesn't have to actually heal anybody or bring anybody together. All we have to do is depict reality. I mean, All in the Family, which was this great, funny show, although you watch it now and you think, oh, so dated. It didn't, I mean, and Norman Lear took a position, like he thought that we should all, you know, we should all be like Meathead. I don't know how old you are, but remember that? And the American people watched it and said, that's funny. I'm not going to be like that weirdo. I'd rather be like Archie Bunker because he's got a job and he pays for the food that they're eating, right? You just have to depict reality, which means you kind of have to live in reality, which is a hard thing to do now in America because rich people just don't know anybody who's not rich. You just don't know anybody. And there's a generation, two generations, three generations of people in show business now who are like, well, I went to Yale and I know my Yale friends. And so you can start pitch meetings.
But don't they know anyone who went to Brown?
Help me out. What is Brown again? Yeah, no. Anyway, so I feel like our job is not to depolarize America. Our job is not to heal America. Our job is not to bring people together. These are terrible jobs, and we're not going to be able to do it anyway. All we have to do is like be honest about the things that are happening around the kitchen table or in a house or in our neighborhood and make jokes about it because they're funny, because the worst, most tragic things are the funniest things. And let the other, let it solve itself. I mean, we get into trouble in show business when we have an outcome other than entertaining, surprising the audience with a reflection of their own concerns, loves, hates, arguments, triumphs. When we decide, oh no, and now I'm going to do that, but I also want you to recycle or vote for Trump, Biden, whatever. That's when we're like, in unfunny territory, and the audience smells it a mile away. So that's my answer, which is not an answer I recognize.
Final question.
Sure. So we've run out of scarcity.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So how do people then follow Jesus with the coats? Because everybody's got a coat.
Everybody's got a coat. I don't know.
You've been working on that the whole evening, haven't you?
Like I've got That's to... not fair.
I don't know.
Yeah, you're not a believer in Jesus, are you?
No, the other team.
I don't know. You just...
But what are the implications then?
In my faith, I'm just called to try. Every day I fail. And every day... I try, and if you'll permit me, seeing as we're, hold on a minute, everybody just, there's a Rumi poem I love, which I can't find now, thanks to somebody. Well, there's a St. Teresa prayer, right? Christ is no body now but yours, no hands, no feet on earth but yours. Yours are the eyes through which he looks compassion on this world. Yours are the feet with which he walks to do good. Yours are the hands through which he blesses all the world. Yours are the hands, yours are the feet, yours are the eyes, you are his body. Christ has no body now on earth but yours. you do what you can do.
All right. We're going to leave it there. I want to thank Rob Long for talking to Reason. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, to Google, to Spotify, to SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up, subscribe. Don't miss a single episode. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. You can sign up for our other podcast series, including the Reason Roundtable, the SoHo Forum Debates, Just Asking Questions, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and even The Best of Reason, where a robotic AI voice trained on Catherine Mangu Ward's vocal utterances reads new great stories from Reason. So go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up. Subscribe to all of them. Thanks for listening.